Flute fans, Alton Brown here. You are listening to the Alton Brown Cast. We've got a show that I think is pretty interesting today. I'm going to spend the entire time doing an interview, and it's with someone. If you spend time in the South, you know that there's not a lot of chocolate made down here. Maybe it's because it melts. Maybe it's just because this is not a traditional home of chocolate. But a fellow in Nashville, name of Scott Witherow, has a company called Olive & St. Clair Chocolate Company. And they don't just make chocolate bean to bar. They make great chocolate bean to bar. And I'm really interested in people that are making a local product. I know we use the word artisanal. I used to say artisanal, but that's actually a well. It's artisanal products. We talk about that way too much, probably. I mean, we as a culture. This is just a dude that really likes to make chocolate, and he's making really, really good chocolate. So we're going to spend our time talking to him today. He's got a lot to say, and I hope that you'll enjoy the chat. So Alton Brown here. This is the Alton Brown Cast. Things are kind of noisy in the background, and that's because I'm sitting next to a couple of very large rock rollers that are grinding up some chocolate here at the Olive & St. Clair factory in Nashville, Tennessee. And I'm sitting across the table from the, I guess you're the proprietor. You're the only guy that owns this joint?
Yeah.
The chocolatier here, Scott Witherow. This is your place. Thanks for having us, and thanks for being on the show.
Awesome. Thank you.
So, I've read your bio. I've done my research. I've eaten a lot of your chocolate, probably more than I should, although chocolate's relatively healthy stuff. You've got an interesting story, kind of your personal story coming up to how this happened for you. And I always like to include origin stories whenever I'm dealing with food people. So, do me a favor and give me the short form of how you got here.
To try to make a long story short.
You don't have to make the long story short, but go ahead and tell the tale.
I mean, I've always been obsessed with food, and I mean, especially sweets and things of that nature. I used to drink the grenadine whenever my mom would bring it home. I would just sit in the pantry and literally chug it. I just always wanted to be in food. Started working in restaurants when I was 15 at the Sizzler, and
the Sizzler. Did they have the little plastic medium and rare little toothpick thingies
exactly.
to go into the really bad steaks, which are only about that thick?
It was terrible, and I was lucky enough to be the bus boy for all of that goodness.
Do you remember how old you were when you were a bus boy?
15.
You were 15.
Yeah.
Okay.
That was as early in Tennessee as you could get a job, I believe. But anyway, I kind of worked in restaurants through high school. And wanted to go to culinary school. My parents, they told me that they wanted me to go to college, or quote college,
school, real
exactly.
education, sure.
Business kind of school kind of deal. And they would pay for it. If I wanted to go to culinary school, they said, knock yourself out. So I went to college and just continued working in restaurants, mostly just sandwich places, catering companies, yada, yada. And eventually finished college, and then still wanted to go to culinary school.
What was your degree in? Did you get a business degree?
Yeah, it was in advertising and PR.
Okay.
And I've never used an ounce of it outside of, I guess, maybe you could argue that I use it here.
I would argue that you're using it every day, sure.
So thanks, Mom and Dad. I still wanted to be in the food industry. So I went back to my parents. I said, I still want to go to culinary school because I didn't know how else to get my foot in the door kind of a deal. So I had applied to Johnson & Wales in Charleston, South Carolina, but just didn't feel right. So I bought a one-way ticket to London because I was reading a lot about the England food scene at the time. And that was around 2002, I believe. And so anyway, I went to school, did my apprentices and, just started working anywhere and everywhere I could. Moved back to England to go back to work, to Chicago, Birmingham, anywhere I could to get more experience.
And well, you worked in some pretty serious kitchens.
I did.
Yeah. I thought I saw Fat Duck on your resume.
Sir. Yeah.
Alinea, places like that.
Yeah. I've been very fortunate to spend some time in some awesome kitchens. Fat Duck was one. I was able to spend a few days in St. John's, which is Fergus Henderson's place. And that, to me, was just an honor just to even be in that kitchen.
So you weren't there long?
No. That was just a couple days.
What did you learn there in a couple of days? I mean, it's one of the most, I don't know, vaunted kitchens in the world.
I mean, even...
St. John's.
Like, even, you know, these guys putting me to work to make the ketchup that they make there was just so... There's such a passion in that kitchen for using everything. And I realize that that's... You know, that's kind of a, I don't know, like a hot word these days. It's like, you know, farm to table or whatever, nose to tail, blah, blah, blah. But for me at that point, you know, it was something that I wasn't seeing anywhere else. You know, Alinea, the couple weeks that I was in that kitchen, you know, Grant Atchez only has to kind of look at you and say, you know, you need to move a little faster, chef. Doesn't even have to get out the first two words for you to start working a little bit faster. You know,
or a hell of a lot faster.
Yeah, exactly. I've been fortunate to, you know, spend time in some great kitchens.
So when did the move to chocolate take place for you?
As I was trying to learn more about, you know, cooking, you know, I started spending time in a lot more of the, like, molecular level of cooking.
Sure.
As much as I wanted to go that route, it just didn't feel natural to me. But it got my head to thinking of how stuff works and how things, you know, the kind of the science behind chocolate for me. So I started reading about, you know, the process of making chocolate and how we kind of control the flavors of chocolate. And so that's kind of what pushed me into it. And so I started, again, just reading books, and then I started making 3 to 5 pound batches at a time in my kitchen at home.
What was that like? I mean, what did you use for equipment? I mean, making chocolate at home is not the easiest thing in the world.
No.
I mean, you were making this from bean?
Yeah.
Well, what did you use to grind? Did you conch? What did you do?
I didn't conch at that time, but, I mean, I would roast beans, you know, in an oven. Just on convection or whatever and try to listen to them pop because that's, again, kind of what I had read at the time. And I will say the stuff was terrible. I mean, it was...
Okay, but it was still chocolate.
Inedible.
You still made chocolate in your kitchen.
And then I would use like a Tammy, you know, that I had brought home from school or whatever it was. I can't remember where I got it. And a hairdryer as my winnower. You know, just crack the beans with a rolling pin. And then I had a small, stone grinder. I think it's called a Santha. It's still here in the factory. If we ever want to make small batches just to test something,
uh-huh.
Yeah, we still use that.
I haven't seen
that.
One of those. I'd like to see it.
Yeah, I can show it to you. But yeah, that's how I would make it. And then I would, you know, just temper by hand. I mean, obviously, you know, that's easy enough.
But this was pretty terrible chocolate.
Wretched.
But I had
read about particle size, but had no idea how you would test particle size. I mean, you know, it was still, you know, semi-gritty stuff. That kind of was how I tested it, was by mouthfeel. And in a stone mill, it's relatively impossible to get a completely even particle size without passing it through some sort of filter, which I didn't really have outside of a chinois.
What about the product? What about that process hooked you, though? I mean, here you went through a lot of trouble. You made some really, really, in your words, wretched chocolate, but you were still hooked by it. There must have been some, what was it, just dogged determination, or was there something in those first batches that really hooked you?
I don't know if it was any batch that hooked me, but it was just the process of making it. I mean, again, that's still why we do what we do. I mean, we love the process of making this stuff. And then having somebody, you know, when somebody tries it and they like what you do, I mean, that's, you know, kind of the same aspect from being in a kitchen and, you know, sending out a plate of food that you've worked really hard to, you know, to put those flavors together and make a dish make sense. You know, when we do the same thing with a chocolate bar.
Okay, so you're making 3 to 5 pound batches of really wretched chocolate. What happened?
Again, I would test it out on friends, and eventually somebody, I did something right, because people started to like what I was doing. Honestly, I think one of the ones that my friends liked was the buttermilk white. That was one that I did initially because it's easy to make, but it just made sense to me.
And that's also a Southern idea, buttermilk.
Yeah,
who else was making something like that? Who else was putting buttermilk into white chocolate?
To my knowledge, nobody. The concept of Southern artisan chocolate, which it's actually something that we've trademarked, that is our kind of process.
See, there's your college degree working for you.
Exactly.
Mom, Dad, it worked.
It's kind of the idea of Southern food kind of defines itself by using what we had access to, you know, be it collard greens, you know, bacon, things of that nature. We try to do the same thing. We have access to bourbon barrels, so we age cacao in bourbon barrels. We have access to smokehouses, so we smoke cacao for certain products. The buttermilk, that's a Southern staple. So instead of just using regular milk to make yet another, in my opinion, bad white chocolate, or I thought that we needed some sort of acid to balance that just coy, sweet fattiness of white chocolate, and buttermilk just makes sense.
It makes complete sense.
And again, we have access to buttermilk around here, so.
It's the only white chocolate, I'll be honest, that I really like, because I find most white chocolate one note, cloyingly sweet, makes your teeth hurt.
Thank you.
And I think that may have been the first of your products that I even have. All right, so people started liking it. Friends started liking it. Then you got together some money.
Yeah.
Keep going.
Well, I mean, and it was really important to me to make the chocolate that I was making, that we were going to put out. I wanted to make it as personable and Southern as it was quality to me.
How do you do that?
Well, to me, the wrapper. A lot of chocolate, to me, it almost looks like soap. The packaging is just very, I don't know. It's just boring. It doesn't
lacks character.
It kind of takes some of the fun out of a chocolate bar.
Did you say fun?
Yeah, I mean,
like when you're a kid. It's the Willy Wonka golden ticket.
I mean, we have the best job in the world. I mean, it is fun to work here. You know, it is fun to make chocolate.
Heck yeah!
It should also say that on the package to me. So all that stuff I started to try to think about all that. So we got a local guy here, a friend of mine, that's a letterpress printer to carve our wrapper out of wood. And initially we were hand printing everything on like an old Heidelberg press.
Wow.
But kind of a blessing and a curse, that was quickly an impossibility. So we had to kind of redesign it using as much of the template that he had, you know, carved as we could. So that was part of it. And then I guess this is kind of backtracking. But whenever I was testing chocolate to make commercially, you know, you've got to think about, you know, how you're going to grind chocolate. And for me, it was just a knee-jerk reaction to stone grind, really, because I just from the thought of grits. I mean, that's kind of, again, what we do around here.
We've got a corn tradition in the South, and you use stone wheels.
Exactly. You know, I was reading and I was researching. Then I, you know, started sourcing some old stone mills to, you know, to actually stone grind.
Well, tell us, I'm going to take you off your story for a second, because we are sitting next to a pretty amazing device. Tell us about what we're sitting next to.
I'm
going to try to get some sounds off of it.
Sure. We love the stone mills that we use. They're old granite, you know, stone grinders that were, we located them from Spain, though I know one of them's from France. But they've been dated anywhere from 1900 to 1920. They're just giant granite wheels that weigh about 2,500 pounds a piece, I think. And that's what we use to, to stone grind our, you know, our cacao.
When people come here and look around, are they ever shocked that you would be using something that is open, you know, all exposed like this?
Well, typically we have a guard that goes around, and then there's like a little... There is a top that they can put on it.
But let's face it, this is an old process. I mean, yeah. This has got to be, you know, people are so used to all of their food coming out of stainless steel. To see something as physical and as kind of old school as this grinding away must kind of shock people. I know the first time I saw one, it was at the old Scharfenberger factory in South San Francisco back before they got bought up. Yep. And I was blown away by all this turn of the century German equipment that they had. And the first time that I saw the rocks rolling, I was like, my gosh, I didn't think that was really like that anymore.
Well, I mean, no, everybody that comes in here, I mean, this is the machine that they fall in love with. Honestly, not too many people come down here because we're kind of...
Well, I think people should. I mean, when people come in and want to see you make chocolate, do you show them around?
Oh, absolutely. But again, just you see kind of where we're located now. We don't get a lot of foot traffic.
Not a lot of foot traffic in this particular neighborhood, except for people in the neighborhood, probably.
But we will in the new shop.
Yeah. Matter of fact, by the time this podcast is up, you'll be in your new home.
Cool. Yeah, so come see us.
Getting a piece of equipment like this shipped in and putting it back together again must be a real labor of love.
Slash pain, but yeah.
Yeah, a lot of pain. I mean, how many crates does a machine like this take up?
Both of them actually came in one crate.
Are you serious?
Yeah, and they were intact outside of the gears and the motors. Those parts were taken apart. But
it's still half a ton of... No, more than half a ton.
I mean...
2,500 a piece on the stones.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. So I mean, you're looking at, I think each machine's about 6,000 pounds. Yeah.
Several tons.
But the hard part wasn't getting it over here. The hard part was like taking it apart, and then you know we had to cast certain parts that were, you know, either had holes in them or cracked or whatever, and then putting it back together.
Well, no matter what kind of machines you have, no matter how soulful your recipes, no matter how much of a Southern flair you bring to your final product, you can't make chocolate if you don't have beans. You don't have the stuff. What is your journey been as far as finding the goods, finding the right ingredients?
To me, it's just been kind of a trial and error thing. Initially, when we first started out, actually, I was using some beans from Panama. And they're great beans, but they just weren't what I was looking for. But again, you know, when I was first starting out, and we're still learning, but when I was first starting out, I had no idea that, you know, that why I was getting this just intense woodiness from the beans in Panama.
Woodiness?
Yeah. This is kind of actually how we came up with our salt and pepper bar. I had, I think, 600 pounds of beans from Panama. And I had made a batch of chocolate out of them, and I, you know, I was getting ready to launch the company at an event called Tomato Art Fest here in East Nashville. And I was just going to give chocolate away, but I wasn't willing to give away the chocolate I had made out of the Panama beans because it wasn't what I was looking for. And that was what I was looking for was our 67% now, which is
67% cacao.
Yes, sir. To me, I mean it's super fudgy, and I realize that that's kind of an odd thing to say about a chocolate bar, but, you know, some cacao can be chocolatier than others, and that's kind of what I was looking for. With our 67%, it's kind of got highlights or subtleties of like fig and brown butter.
That's where you're getting the fudgy from, sure.
Exactly, but this stuff was just very woody and not so much chocolatey and not so much floral. It was just very earthy stuff. So I was trying to get it more to where I wanted it, and kind of like you would a tomato. If the tomato's not, you know, not in season, not wonderful, you know, you season it with a little kosher salt and fresh cracked pepper, tends to make it at least passable. So that's what we did to the Panama.
And was it passable?
It worked. Yeah, we started giving chocolate away that day, and you know, a couple weeks later, we were in Whole Foods.
Were you actually dissolving the salt into the mixture, or were you adding it near the end so that there would still be wholesome flakes involved?
Yeah, no, we hand season each bar.
Okay,
like
was it
you
just
would
on
tomato.
The outside? You were literally seasoning it the way you would food.
Yeah, like
and you had done that after tempering, mm-hmm. probably, obviously, so that the, those flakes set up. I mean, you, exactly. you still have that crunch.
And we still do every bar like that. I mean, or every inclusion bar that we do. Like our nib bar is hand molded, and then we take nibs by hand and you know, lay the inclusion in them. Of course, we've got a vibrating table that kind of helps.
Yeah, I hear it.
Yeah. settle the nibs or the salt and pepper, whatever, in there.
Got it. So that was what year? How long ago was that?
That was in 2009.
So things have happened pretty quickly.
We've been very blessed, lucky, and hardworking in that order. Yes.
Got it. I understand.
But
that's a good order.
Are good.
So you found yourself in Whole Foods.
I mean, I think we'd been open for 2 months, and we got a call from Gwyneth Paltrow. And she
did
ordered,
she literally, like, hi, this is Gwyneth?
Well, no, it was like her people or whatever. But she bought, like, I don't remember how many hundred bars and sent them out to her friends. And
where had she heard of it?
I don't know. I think
you didn't think to ask, why does Gwyneth Paltrow want my chocolate?
And then, you know, like, then I think Southern Living, you know, did something on us. And then it was Food and Wine. And just slowly we started to gain, you know, some...
some notoriety. Well, you were really the only... I mean, how many bean-to-bar operations are there south of the Mason-Dixon line?
At that point, I couldn't find any, to be perfectly honest. Now, I have heard of some since.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that I was the first, because I don't know that I was, but I didn't...
Well, I'm pretty sure you were. I mean, from my research, I think you were the first.
But I didn't know of any at the time. Another interesting thing to me about what we do is we only use pure brown sugar in the chocolate that we make. Which, again, to my knowledge, we're the only chocolate makers in the world that do that.
Why do you do it?
Again, initially it was a knee-jerk reaction, just thinking about what... If you're going to make chocolate, okay, you've got cacao beans that you've got to find, right, and what you want to use...
Well, that's okay. I made you jump over because we were talking about the Panamanian, and then now you've switched over to Dominican Republic and some Ghana,
yeah,
right? Mostly.
Exactly.
And has that been? Have you had to travel a lot to figure that out?
I have not. We really want to get over to the Dominican soon, but just kind of one of those deals where you got to crawl before you can walk. We just haven't made that jump.
You seem to be concerned about where stuff comes from and how it's grown, though.
Absolutely. I mean, we deal direct with the farmers in the Dominican Republic, you know, and have contact with them. So we know, you know, how stuff's grown, what kind of beans they are, how long they're fermented, yada, yada, you know. And occasionally we'll do, you know, like cut tests and, you know, we get mold percentages and whatnot on the beans, you know, so that we know what we're working with, you know. And we have a personal relationship with them. We just haven't, you know, made the move to go down there and see them personally or see a farm yet.
Have you been on a farm?
No, sir. Never have.
It's something.
Oh, man. I bet.
Most people use a blend of beans or they just settle down on one farm or two farms that they like, but it's an agricultural product. And if you're going to have any kind of real stability in your product, you probably have to do some blending. I mean, year to year, right?
Yeah. Well, what do you mean?
Well, I mean, you're going to source from a few different places. You're going to use a mixture of beans to give your particular product a consistency.
Yeah.
That's what I hear from a lot of chocolatiers.
I mean, we only use beans from two different places.
So right now, you have how many flavors?
We've got 9 bars that we do.
And not all of those have things added to them.
No.
Some of them are just, you got your straight 67 bar.
Yeah. And
what is your darkest bar at this point?
75.
75.
Yeah.
As far as I'm concerned, that's kind of the cutoff for anything I'm going to eat anyway. I mean,
I know there are people out there that really like that, you know.
You get up like an 89 and stuff.
Yeah,
to me, that's Baker's chocolate. 90. I just don't want to eat it.
Yeah.
I'll cook with it, but I don't want to eat it.
Yeah, I mean, we do, and we do sell, like, you know, just straight liquor to certain clients and you know, for restaurant use and,
sure,
and things of that nature. But now 75 is the darkest we go on a bar.
When you're looking for inspiration, I mean, I always want to know where people get it. You know, the inspiration for coming up with any aspect of your product, from the flavors that you add, the packaging. Clearly, you're at home now. You know, you've traveled around and you found, you know, you came back because you really wanted to be in the South. So you got that base, that part of your personality taken care of. But on a day-to-day basis, as you expand, where do you look? Where does the inspiration come from? If you don't mind me asking.
I mean, the inspiration honestly does come from what we kind of have access to, but it also just has to make sense. You know, just from a cooking standpoint, a lot of people have asked us to do a bacon bar or whatever, you know, which is,
please don't do that.
Yeah. No, I mean, just it's been done, and it's been done kind of badly, in my opinion.
I'm personally a little tired of bacon. I'm taking a little bacon break right now. So
yeah.
But
kind of the flip side of that was, our buddy Alan Benton out in Madisonville, Tennessee, we were actually ordering bacon from him one day, and he said, you know, Scott, you ought to send me some of them cocoa beans. You do not correct Alan Benton, you know, but you agree with him. So I said, yes, sir, I'd love to send some to you. And so he sent them back, and he smoked the cacao for us. And instead of doing a bacon bar, I mean, we do a smoked nib brittle. But again, that the overt smokiness, especially from a smokehouse like Alan Benton's, to me makes sense with, you know, the buttery sweetness, you know, of a brittle or a toffee. I mean, an inspiration for packaging, I'm a sucker for antiques and old things, so anything we do is inspired by, you know, stuff that tells a story.
Stuff that tells a story.
Yeah, I think that's what old stuff is. I mean, that's what, I don't know. I mean, outside of my truck, we try hard to buy old stuff.
But not your truck.
No, not my truck.
New truck.
I got to get from A to B, you know, and...
Hey, man, you can continue to be in an old truck.
Yeah.
You just got to be able to work it, you know?
Yeah, I know.
Mechanically minded.
I got a 40-minute drive here every day, though, so...
Vintage has its limits.
Exactly.
Have you always been that way? Is vintage...
Always, yeah. I mean, I drive a 1962 Vespa, you know, if I'm not driving to here. But yeah, I've always been that way. I've never lived in a new house. I just never like new stuff. It doesn't make sense to me.
The older I get, the more of a problem I have with new, mostly because I find it lacks an authenticity.
Yeah.
And I know that there's another word that gets thrown around way too much, but I don't have a replacement for authenticity yet.
Yeah.
I guess that I've gotten to the point where I feel like objects have a certain amount of soul. And I've always, whether it's as a filmmaker or as a cook or anything else, I want my things to have soul.
Yeah.
I mean, I flew up here today in an airplane that was manufactured in 1979.
You're kidding.
I like old movie cameras, you know, that... I like old watches. I never gravitate towards anything new, oddly enough.
Yeah, I mean...
Except for maybe a phone.
Yeah, I mean, I'm the same way. Yeah, I want my truck and I want my iPhone, but, you know, other than
Outside of that, back off.
Yeah,
I still
exactly.
listen to vinyl records. And,
yeah.
But I think it's probably, for me, I've reached an age where my brain is slowly going back, you know, to the past to find things to hold on to.
Oh, no, you know? I'm with you. You got to go to Grimey's if you're a vinyl person.
Here, that's in Nashville, isn't
it? Yeah,
I've heard of it.
Yeah.
I used to work out of a company here about 20 years ago, but I lived in Atlanta and worked out of here. Do you think that as clearly your product and your company they feel farm to table, you know, which, you know, is a move that I think is about people trying to find authenticity in their food?
Sure.
Do you identify with food movements?
We're not as involved with, like, the SFA as we would like to be, but, I mean, we can't work farm to table because cacao is only grown 20 degrees north and south of the equator.
That's so farm to table in a way, though. You can't do local, maybe, but, you know, isn't the whole idea of farm to table getting something from where it's grown to the table with as few steps as possible? I mean, is that how you define that?
Well, I mean, yeah, I guess so. I mean, I guess...
Well, then you do it.
And the ways that we try to do it are, like, working with... folks like Alan Benton, folks like the guys at Corsair, which is like our local distiller, you know, local dairies, things to that nature.
Got it. Chocolate has become very in vogue. People have, at least in this country, have access to more types of chocolate and well-made chocolate than ever before. Do you still find that there are gaps in people's chocolate knowledge that you'd like to fill?
Yeah, and I think there's probably gaps in my chocolate knowledge that I want to fill. I mean, you know, just like any other, you know, food or product, I mean, you're always learning how to get, you know, a different note or a, you know, or a different subtlety that maybe you weren't able to get before, or a different flavor, mouthfeel, anything to that nature. I mean, you, like you're saying, we have access to so many different chocolates these days, and to me, it's super interesting to sit down and taste what some of the other guys are doing. Not to say up against ours, but just up against each one, just to see the differences. Like you mentioned Scharfenberger before, eating a Scharfenberger bar and eating one of our bars, they could be the same percentage, and they're going to be two totally different beasts.
Completely different.
But yeah, I think there's a lot of voids and areas of learning, you know.
Are there any things that you wish everybody out there, people that are going to be listening to this podcast, knew about chocolate that they probably don't?
I think the biggest thing that you don't know about chocolate is how hard it is to make. I mean, every single bean is, you know, for us, is hand-sorted, is hand-fed into a winnower. You know, and then
and a winnower is the device that removes that outer
shell
off
the
nib,
bean,
right?
Okay. And all that's after you've found a source that you like, that, you know, they have, you know, picked the pods, fermented the you know, the cacao, dried it, bagged it, and then shipped it, you know, to us in the States. I mean, you can imagine how expensive it gets, you know, just to even get them to our factory, and then, you know, and then it takes, you know, 10 hands, you know, to get it into a chocolate bar.
Because as we're sitting here in the middle of your factory floor, over to my left is your roaster, which is pretty much a coffee bean roaster. They're like the same type of machine.
Sure.
Then we've got a winnower. Then we've got the grinder here that we're sitting right next to. And then there's a concher on the other end of the room.
Oh.
I noticed whenever I try to explain this process to folks, conching is the most mysterious to people. How do you explain conching to folks? Or do you try?
And I guess this could answer that other question that you were asking me about what people don't know about chocolate. A lot of times, conching gets a bad rap.
Why is that?
Because a lot of people argue that it, like, you know, that it takes all the antioxidants out of chocolate, which it can, or that
a lot of the volatiles.
Exactly. But to me, it's, you know, we use it as, you know, you're able to reduce particle size quicker, which to me kind of keeps some of the flavors of the actual bean. But then also you are able to get rid of some of the bitterness. Kind of the catch is that, you know, as you're reducing particle size, some of that bitterness wants to get out into the air, much like chlorophyll wants to go out into the water whenever you're cooking something green. But you've kind of got to control that, you know, the chlorophyll, or for us, the volatiles that have some of the bitterness, but also, you know, hold the antioxidants and all the subtleties that we've worked so hard to, you know, to highlight in our chocolate. So most of the time people are conching for anywhere from 48 to 72 hours. I mean, we conch a batch of chocolate, and a batch could be anywhere from 300 to 600 pounds, but we do that within an 8-hour work period. So we tend to run ours kind of short and hard, try to get rid of some of the bitter notes, but then keep all the other goodness that's in the bean, be it the subtleties of the, you know, the freshly roasted bean itself, but then also the antioxidants and everything that people want in their chocolate.
For those who don't know, can you just run through what conching actually is?
Sure. So more or less, if you've got a bowl, if it were turned on its side, and then if, say, when you put your whisk attachment on there and you turn it on its highest speed, as it runs faster, a conch actually applies more pressure to the outside walls. And then the walls themselves are ribbed, so it's smearing the chocolate liquor against the side of the wall to reduce particle size, right? As it's doing that, it's also tossing the liquid chocolate up into the air. And then there's a fan running that's kind of flushing air over the chocolate itself. And again, what that does is the the bitterness of chocolate initially wants to be out into the air, so that exposure...
It's volatile, so it wants to get out.
Exactly. But the catch is after the bitterness goes, then all your other subtleties will start to go out the window. And once they're gone, they're gone. But, of course, you know, you may not want, say, the woodiness of a you know, the Panama beans. Again, if I knew then what I know now, I could have done some things differently to maybe get where I wanted. But I didn't. But in conching that, after the bitterness goes, some of those woody notes may start to get really big, you know, after a couple hours. Then after a couple hours, they may just totally go out the window, and you start to get more like red fruit notes or floral notes and things to that nature. So, and the other part of that is particle size. Particle size also kind of dictates kind of the flavors on your tongue. So, that's in a nutshell what conching does.
How much is the actual aroma of the final chocolate affected?
It's affected, I mean, pretty hugely at that point. If you're in here when we're conching, especially for the first like 3 hours, when you walk out, you will stink to high heaven. I mean, the bitterness literally sticks.
Sticks to you.
Oh yeah,
those are very sticky molecules.
Yeah, it's
also a very loud machine. I'm glad you're not running it.
It is. I don't wear ear protection anymore, but that's because again, I guess my hearing went out the window too.
Yeah. Don't really need it.
Funny story about conching to me. I stop at this little coffee house next to my house every morning. Typically, I've got a shirt over my Alvin Sinclair shirt, as I do now. But I'll take off, you know, whatever that shirt is when I get to work. That morning, I forgot to do so. And, you know, we'd been conching all week. And, yes, I shower in the morning, but it doesn't come off that easy.
No,
every
stuff.
Yeah. So, anyway, I went in to get my regular, you know, large coffee, no cream, no sugar. And the girl was like, oh, you know, wow, you know, do you work at Oliver Sinclair? And I just kind of said, just kind of smirked. I was like, you know, yeah, I do. And she said, you know, can we get one of those shirts, blah, blah, blah. And she said, man, I don't know what I was thinking at. She said, I didn't know you worked there. She said, I always thought you were into landscaping. And it was because...
You smell like manure.
Yeah, because I smell so bad every morning just from conching. Not to turn
story.
People off from conching, but...
No, there's a lot of the same... But, aromas, they're volatile, ammonia-like sometimes.
Yeah, and without conching, some of that stuff is in your,
you know, in the chocolate.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, yeah, some European chocolates conch. I mean, like you had said, you're talking 23 to 30 hours.
Yeah.
Until the chocolate's amazingly smooth, but I find a little flat. I like my chocolate to have a few barbs on it.
Exactly.
I want a little more character.
Yeah.
You know, to me, it's a lot like bourbon. You know, I don't want my bourbon all lickety spank clean. You know, I want there to be some angles,
yeah, some layers,
some cuts,
and
some layers.
Yeah.
Let me discover a little bit of something. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, I might as well just have a bar of lint chocolate and say, well, you know, what does that taste like? It tastes like chocolate.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's it.
And that's, I don't know, but that's the beauty of, I mean, it's the beauty of conching. It's the beauty of having, you know, 30 chocolate makers in America and having, you know, just having access to so many different chocolate bars these days.
Do you think that people are tasting their food differently now? Do you think that cuisine and culinary interest in this country has changed to the point where people will open one of your bars and say, wow, I taste berries in there, I taste butterscotch in there, I taste other things, or are people still just woofing down chocolate?
No, I think people are looking for those subtleties and you know, especially in handcrafted products like ours and, you know, and similar ones. No, I think without question, people want that. You know, they want something to have layers, like you're saying. They don't just want a Lindt chocolate bar anymore.
Or a Hershey's bar.
Yeah.
Saying those things are bad, but it's a different kind of...
There's a time and a place for everything. I mean... But,
I can still enjoy a frozen Hershey's bar with almonds, stick in the freezer for a while. It takes me back to a particular point in my childhood that is a place that I like to go occasionally.
I've never heard of that, but we used to drink frozen sun drops. I don't know if that's outside of Tennessee or not. Sun drops.
Pretty specialized. You have kids?
I have one. I have a 7-month-old. So it's
probably not eating chocolate yet.
Not yet.
Well, make sure that you have a camera on hand the first time she puts some of your chocolate in her mouth.
Oh, I will.
I've seen a lot of pictures of kids when they're getting their first chocolate, and it's always like, oh. oh, that's what I got to look forward
to. Yeah, exactly. Hopefully she likes chocolate. If she's one of those people that doesn't like chocolate, we're going to have issues.
That's an anomaly, though. I don't meet many people that don't like chocolate.
Yeah.
Can you ever see yourself getting to the point where you're just burned out on it?
No. No, not at all. Chocolate's one of those. I mean, we taste every batch here. You know, we test particle size with a micrometer, but it's also about mouthfeel, too. You know, I mean,
science should back up what you taste, not determine what
exactly,
you taste.
Exactly.
You know, it's like taste it, feel it, know it, and then quantify it with science so you get it again.
Yep.
You know, otherwise you're taking the craftsmanship out of things, you know?
Yeah.
Do you still consider yourself a cook?
My wife has never cooked a day in her life. I cook
but even this chocolatiering business, you still approach that as a cook.
Absolutely. Everything we do, that's how we try to think about it first and foremost, really.
And your wife's never cooked a meal?
No. Nope.
She's lucky. She's scored.
I mean, I'm lucky, but...
of course. All husbands are incredibly lucky.
But I love cooking. I honest to goodness, I love cooking more now than I did when I was in restaurants.
Well, the best way to fall out of love of cooking is to work in a restaurant.
Right, exactly.
Because that's no way to live, if you ask me. Some folks love it and thrive on it, and I'm glad I did it. Really glad I did it. But, man, if I never step back there again, it'd be all right by me.
I'm in the same boat. I have the most respect for people that can do it and live that lifestyle, but not myself. You know?
So what's next for you? You're moving into the new place. That's got to be pretty big.
Yeah, that's huge for us.
Are you cooking up new ideas?
Yeah.
Anything you want to share?
We're toying with a couple different things that we're going to launch. One of them is a salt and vinegar caramel.
I tasted one. I want more.
Awesome. Thank you.
I would personally up the salt just a little bit, but that's just me.
I didn't get to tell you over there, but that was my same.
A little more salt would be good.
And then we've got a duck fat caramel that we're doing as well.
Duck fat caramel.
Yeah.
What could be wrong with that?
Nothing.
Nothing.
Well, and I'll let you taste them in a minute. There is a problem with them, and I think you'll get it. I'm sure you'll get it whenever you taste it. When we make them, I mean, we use everything that you would use, say, in a confit or whatnot. So we add a little bit of fresh thyme, you know, salt, pepper, and a touch of hot sauce, and it burns forever at the end. And that's the problem with this batch.
Well, I look forward to tasting this.
And then we do have another line that we're looking at launching. We're kind of in the process of trademarking. It's called charcuterie. It's chocolate charcuterie. We're doing everything from confiting cacao, you know, cooking it in its own fat, and then pureeing it to make chocolate rillettes, things to that nature.
Okay, I don't think anybody's done that before.
We're excited about it.
Yeah.
But again, to me, it just makes sense. I mean, we have.
So you're going to become a Southern Willy Wonka. That's what you're doing, isn't it? You are. You're going to be Willy Wonka the South.
I don't know.
You have like a river of chocolate, and kids will come and. There are worse things to be.
Yeah, we have a lot of stuff that we're working on. And we always just try to have fun with it.
Scott, thanks for being on the podcast.
Awesome. Thank you very much, all.
All right, everybody. That's it for this week's Alton Brownscast. I want to thank Scott Withrow and everybody at Olive & St. Clair Chocolate Company in Nashville, Tennessee, for letting us invade their plant and just set up right in the middle of all that whirring gear. It was not a small interruption to their day, but I'm glad that they took the time to do it. So hope you enjoyed it. Tune in next time when our guest will be, somebody interesting. Oh, and remember, America, cook smart.